Hello again, everyone, and welcome into another episode of the 86 Celtics Interviews. I'm Abby Chin. Current president of basketball operations for the Boston Celtics, Danny Ainge, played a key role as part of the starting five for the 86 Celtics. Ainge complimented his Hall of Fame teammates on that team by being a great outside shooter, plus his tenacious attitude on the floor fit well within what was a unique set of personalities. To start off our interview, Danny talks about his interesting path to becoming a Boston Celtic.
Well, so in the 81 draft, I was playing baseball and still had a year left on my baseball contract. And I had calls from most every NBA team, from the number one pick in the draft to, you know, the top 20 teams in the draft that were inquiring about my status. And I told everybody at that time that I was going to stay in baseball and honor my contract. My last year of my contract. And so I had a lot of conversations with different teams. And then Red said to me, he goes, "Oh, you know, forget baseball. You're not a baseball player." And this was after my 1981 Providence game. I had like 37 points, I think, against UCLA in the NCAA tournament to get us into the final Sweet 16. And Red was pretty convinced that I belonged in a Celtic uniform, and he said, "We're going to draft you." But I never told Red anything different, that I'm going to stay in baseball. And in those days, what I could do is I could stay in baseball, which is what I was planning on doing, and I could either sign with the NBA team at that time that drafted me, or I could go back into the draft the following year. So it was a big risk by drafting me. The Celtics had a lot of draft picks that year. They had three or four picks in the top 30, something 35 picks, and they used one of those on me. And then Red said, "You know, we're going to try to sign you and fight this," and so forth. In 1981, the baseball strike happened, and it was a lockout. And there were fans that I was playing in Toronto, and people were throwing, you know, plastic basketballs out on the field. And at that time, I had talked with Pat Gillick and Bobby Doerr about, you know, wanting to try basketball before I made a final decision, maybe playing for the Celtics for 1 year before I made a final decision on career choice. And anyway, it was a big business. It was a real awakening to me. The Celtics and Blue Jays fought in court over who had rights, and Blue Jays won the battle, and which ensued a big negotiation, trade. The Blue Jays were trying to trade my rights to other baseball teams. I had the Chicago Bulls trying to acquire my rights. George Steinbrenner got me in a box in New York and was talking to me, and they were trying to acquire me for the Bulls and the Yankees to play two sports. Ted Turner was trying to acquire my rights and making trades with the Celtics and to get me to play baseball and basketball for the Hawks and the Braves. There's a lot of things like that going on behind the scenes, and ultimately a settlement happened and with the Blue Jays and the Celtics, and that was history. And my career choice was made right then and there. I think that it was a novelty. I was the College Player of the Year. It was an exciting time, but a very confusing and at the same time sort of frustrating time of being this uncertainty of where I was going to go. And Pat Gillick was my general manager, and Bobby Doerr, the Hall of Fame Red Sox player, was our batting instructor. And I was very close to both of them. Pat had drafted me, the Blue Jays, and Bobby was my batting coach and a very good friend. And they were both trying to talk me into staying with the Blue Jays and about my future in baseball. And I wasn't saying definitely don't want to play baseball. I was just trying to get them to, you know, let me try it for a year. But they had already done that for 4 years with me playing college basketball and pro baseball at the same time. And I think they were ready to, you know, to get some commitment from me and And it was a big money business, and you know, the Celtics paid a big price, and it got me out of my contract in Toronto.
Skipping ahead in Ainge's time with Boston, the end of the 1985 season didn't go as the team had hoped.
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting. You know, my recollection of it is, or perception of, you know, 84, we win the championship, and I actually thought the Lakers were better than we were. And I thought we sort of caught a lot of breaks. And, you know, winning a championship, it does take a lot of breaks. And because the Lakers and Celtics were so equal in 84, 85, things went our way. And we won that championship. I really thought the Lakers were better. I thought in 85 we were better than the Lakers. And, you know, they won the championship. And I thought that that loss in 85 was very painful for us. You know, I think everybody there knew that we were better. And so 86, you know, was, you know, the most competent and confident team I'd ever been around. And it was a very special year. We started the season out with a loss. And we were in New Jersey. I remember, like, Larry was playing practical jokes before the game. Our team was so loose and confident. Larry was tying KC's shoestrings together in our pregame meeting, and, you know, just to get laughs out of everybody. But New Jersey was a good awakening for us. A big loss on Christmas Day with after having a big lead on national TV, and sent us into a 17 out of 18 or 19 out of 20 winning streak after that. But it was just such a competent team. We had tendencies to let people back in the games when we had leads, but we always felt like we were going to win every game.
During the offseason in 1985, the Celtics made a bold move, trading popular forward Cedric Maxwell for Bill Walton.
Well, you know, it was interesting. Max was, you know, one of my favorite teammates in the first part of my career. He was fun, great sense of humor, very loose player, and a very good player. But the knee injury that he had the year before, I think that it took a lot longer to heal than everybody thought it would be. And Max had always joked about, you know, getting a contract and then closing the books, and so he sort of set himself up to have some speculation. But, you know, Max was trying to get back out on the court, doing everything he could, was a great player for us. But McHale was obviously stepping into becoming one of the great all-time players, and Bird, you know, so guys at the same position. And Robert, I think, had just turned 31 or 32. But having that depth at the front court with Walton. And, you know, Walton was sort of a unique player, too, because I think Larry and Kevin and myself, like, we grew up idolizing Walton. I mean, 1977, I was living in Oregon, so I watched him play all through college at UCLA, thinking he's, like, the best player I'd ever seen. And then, you know, in 1977, his NBA championship run was one of the most incredible and individual performances that I've ever witnessed in NBA history. So I had this feeling, and Larry and Kevin, I think, did too, of this, like, Bill Walton is coming to play for the Celtics, you know, and he's going to play this role. And even though he was 33 years old and had some injuries, very, very special mind and size and skill for a guy with that. And he was just a perfect role for him. And it allowed Kevin to thrive more without Max being here and having to share with Max. I think Bill, his minutes, his contribution, his intellect and experience was huge for, and was a big reason why that was such a great team.
As you may have heard in the other episodes, the extremely talented Celtics didn't start the season on the right foot, losing the first game of the year to a lowly New Jersey Nets team.
Yeah, I think that just made everybody mad. And, you know, that was, you know, we didn't like losing, but losing opening night and losing Christmas, those were the two losses that I remember. I remember losing to Portland at home, the only loss, you know, that was more, I don't remember us being as angry about that. In those days, there were no records we were setting. We weren't trying to become the team that had the best record in NBA history. We weren't trying to have the best home court record in history. There wasn't any talk of that. It was only talking about winning a championship. But so, you know, we knew that there would be losses through the course of the year. It's a long season. In the days of commercial travel and 4 o'clock wake-up calls and back-to-backs and you know, getting to the next city. Our whole mission was just to get back. And, you know, we thought it was going to be the Lakers. Like, you know, they were the target for us. And there was a lot of good teams in the Eastern Conference. But, you know, the Lakers were our focus. That 85 loss was very troubling and made our summers very long.
Much had been made about Kevin McHale's decision to spend Christmas morning with his family instead of traveling with the team the night before.
So I think that there were guys that were a little frustrated with Kevin not doing it. You know, Kevin was a dear friend of mine. You know, I think all of us want to stay home on Christmas, you know, with the kids. But, you know, those are hard choices. Those are hard decisions. And so I never batted an eye about it. You know, you have to do things in this life and make tough choices. But, you know, we still had a 20-something point lead, you know, in the game. You know, I don't think that Kevin McHale flying in Christmas morning had anything to do with the loss. And, you know, and I respect Kevin for his decision and standing up for something that he really believed in. And, but, you know, the loss itself was just a tough loss. You know, it was just, New York was not a great team. It was a team that we should have beat, and like we, you know, but it was a pattern with the team that year. It was a pattern that we would get these big leads and then maybe get a little bored and complacent. And because again, our minds were really always on the Lakers and the NBA championship. There was a lot of talk about like sacrifice. You know, we gotta make some sacrifices. And you know, some guys' sacrifices was no beer. Some guys' sacrifices was, you know, getting up more shots in practice, you know, pregame, just really dedicating their lives. Some guys' sacrifice was, you know, I'm going to get to bed by 12 o'clock every night. And, you know, but, like, there was a lot of talk at that time of each player making a sacrifice, whatever it was that you felt like you needed to sacrifice to, you know, to make winning a championship the most important thing. And, but it was something that I think that was important. I think it was a bonding experience on top of it being, you know, like every player should make some sacrifices to be the best player they can be, since that is their career. First of all, Larry has had back-to-back MVPs, and he's like headed toward a third MVP. And, you know, Larry, there's a lot of things that are said about Larry and what a great player he was. And I think in 1986, he was a 26-10-8 player, you know, with great percentages. I mean, he was amazing, incredible, the best rebounder, the best passer, the best shooter, and the toughest minded, the hardest working, you know, guy on our team, and the most confident. And his confidence really brought confidence to the rest of us. But yeah, with a guy like Larry, who's at the prime of his career, who's the best player in the NBA, that gave us amazing confidence. And then you with the next to him is Kevin McHale, who is 28 in the prime of his career, our best defender, our second best shot blocker, or maybe our best shot blocker, I don't remember, but you know, he and the most efficient scorer, you know, he was automatic on the post. Nobody could guard him. We were a matchup nightmare. And you have Robert, who's only 31 or 32 in his prime of his career, and DJ at 31. And I was 26, you know, playing the best basketball of my life. And I just felt like that's why the team was so special, is everybody was like in the prime, still in the prime. But Larry and Kevin in particular were at their very, very best. There was never a better Larry Bird and never a better Kevin McHale than in 1986. And I think that they were so special that it was, you know, an amazing confidence boost. And then we had a guy like Scott Wedman, who was like the highest paid player in the NBA, who we had gotten in a trade. And, you know, he was an all-star coming off our bench, along with Walton, who we know is a top 50 player of all time. And Seasting, Jerry Seasting was a great shooter. And it was, it was a very, it was really hard to not be confident that there's no team out there that could beat us.
As we all know, there aren't many people more competitive than Danny Ainge. One of them, though, is of course his teammate, Larry Bird.
We had fun competition internally all the time. Larry and I used to play one-on-one, sort of half-court one-on-one before practice very often each day to get loose and warmed up. And but we had friendly competitions. Yeah, the end of the season free throw competition was sort of a game within a game that was sort of fun that we were all having. But that's a fun story. That's a funny story. But yeah, it was. I still wish KC would have let it play out the way I was hoping to play it out, was to get some cash out of Larry. But anyway, it was. We always had friendly competition, no question about it. I remember in. Like it was 1985, I believe, where we're playing Detroit, who was a very good up-and-coming team, and Isaiah, who, you know, is one of the great players of all time. And KC told my job was to, like, get under the skin of Isaiah. And maybe it was even 1984, but, you know, my job was to make Isaiah to try to shoot 30 times a game and get him out of, but just want to beat me, you know. And I actually in high school and college had a pretty good reputation of getting under the skin of our opponents as well. So that wasn't really a stretch for me. But by the time 1986 rolled around, I was really comfortable with being the villain. I was really comfortable with being booed in other arenas for, you know, fouling Magic on a fast break and, you know, intentionally just wrapping him up so we didn't have to see the incredible pass to James Worthy for the, you know, high-flying dunks. But, you know, the crowd loved to boo me, and I was really, really comfortable in that role for the Celtics. And I got the ultimate compliment from Walton during that season when he, one time in a moment of passion and frustration with our team, said, you know, that I was the only one on the team doing my job because I'm being booed in every arena in the NBA. And so I go, thanks, Bill. It's like a great compliment. And he meant it that way. Like, you know, that's our job, is to go out there and, like, make everybody hate us and want to beat us so bad.
Throughout that season, a rematch against the Lakers seemed inevitable.
The Lakers, like I said, from the beginning of the season, at least from my perspective and my memory, is, you know, it was all about the Lakers and us winning a championship. But I think everybody had enough respect for the Lakers and what they had done to us in 85. And, you know, the matchup that, you know, we were fortunate enough to win in 84, that we thought for sure they were our rivals. And that was the team that was going to be in our way to win the championship in 86. And I don't think any of us had any doubts that we were going to have the Lakers again and have another crack at the Lakers.
The Celtics were a team of stars and personalities, and this was never more evident than when the team was on the road.
It was really amazing. It was a real awakening of how many Celtic fans there were in every arena. The Celtics were, I mean, we were like the Beatles everywhere we'd go, every hotel we'd go to. Every arena we'd go to, there was people, you know, at 5 o'clock that were in the building watching us warm up, watching us shoot before games, wearing Celtics green, wearing, you know, I hate Celtics, I hate Danny Ainge t-shirts, wearing, I mean, you know, whatever their motives were, it was, you know, there was a lot of attention. And everywhere we went, we'd roll into a hotel at 2 o'clock in the morning and there was, or, you know, I shouldn't say that, it was more like 7 o'clock in the morning because we were taking commercial flights, you know, and there were people at the airports because we were flying commercial that were waiting for us and taking pictures. So it was a very unique year that way. And we did have a lot of attention everywhere we went. I think we knew we were really good. I think that all the attention was more annoying than, you know, We didn't want the attention. We'd rather not have people waiting for us and that we could go in peace. But, you know, we did have a swagger and a confidence, you know, again, led by Larry. But it was, you know, Dennis Johnson was a player with a great deal of swagger. And Kevin, of course, had amazing confidence. And Walton and, you know, right on down the line. It was a really, really fun team to play with. You knew that there was no timid mindset of any of the players on that team.
The top-seeded Celtics drew Chicago in round one, and their confidence level continued to soar.
Oh, I don't think that we viewed the Bulls as a threat, although, you know, Michael hadn't played most of that year. After we swept that series, it was, you know, he had gotten our attention. You know, I think everybody in the world knew that Michael Jordan was somebody to be reckoned with. And I had played golf with Michael. I think we played 36 holes of golf before the game where he ended up with 63 the next day. And but he was a very special talent. But yeah, I don't think we viewed them as a real rival at that point, but they did get our attention, and Michael was obviously fresh and off a season of rest and health, and that was sort of a coming out party. I think everybody knew that he was the best player in the world at that point. Well, I've teased Michael in the past, you know, I think that he had 63 on us. I think he had 48 in regulation or something, but something ridiculous. But I hadn't even scored a point, I think, through the first 2.5 quarters of that game. And I remember that DJ went out with his fifth foul. And so I was given the assignment to not only guard Jordan, but Jordan then was guarding me. And I tease him often. I scored 24 points the rest of that game. So DJ getting in foul trouble helped me get going and have some opportunities to score in that game. And Michael wasn't really doing a very good job defending me in that game. After, you know, I'm playing against Michael in the NBA Finals a couple times in Portland and Phoenix later. You know, his defense had greatly improved. But his offensive talents were just so special. And, you know, he got our attention for sure. But, you know, as great as individual performance as that was, and I remember in that game, Walton fouls out of the game and he curses me out, screaming and yelling because we were doing a lot of switching in that game, and he got himself fouled on Michael Jordan. Michael beat him off the dribble, drew a foul, and got to the basket. And I remember Bill just, and I remember laughing so hard because Bill was so funny that way, but he was so serious and intense about it. He was cursing at me because we were switching the Jordan pick and rolls and the Jordan pin downs and so forth, and he was finding himself. And I don't know how many times Bill fouled out in his career, but not very many.
Ainge reflects back on a signature moment from the second round matchup against Atlanta and a monster 36-6 third quarter in the deciding game.
I remember just, you know, when our team really wanted to and really had to, we were so special. I mean, it was just, yeah, I mean, that's why it's just hard for me to imagine just having those feelings and reliving those experiences of like anybody in the world since before ever beating us. Because even though we weren't locked in for 82 game schedule as we could have been, and you know, it was a different world in those days with travel and so forth. And again, there wasn't the media and all the records. We weren't chasing records. We were just chasing a championship. And maybe those little things might have given us more incentive had we known some of the records that we were trying to accomplish and making history. But our objective was just to win. And but I remember that Atlanta game. I remember just you know, how amazing that quarter was against Atlanta. And I remember the same thing happening when we lost the game in the NBA Finals, the Ralph Sampson game, but we'll talk about that later.
Defense, rebounding, and toughness were all hallmarks of that 86 team. The biggest strength, though, according to Ainge, was their passing ability.
Everybody could pass. I mean, I just think that if you watched everybody in their careers play with the Celtics, before the Celtics, while they were in college, I mean, we just had incredible passers, led by Bill, Larry, and DJ were, you know, off the charts great passers. Maybe the greatest passing forward of all time, maybe the greatest passing center of all time, and, you know, one of the elite, you know, point guards, which there's many of. And I think that Jerry Seesting was an underrated passer, and Kevin McHale was an underrated passer who got double teamed a lot. So yeah, I think it was a very unselfish team, first of all, foremost, but unselfishness doesn't always lead to great passing. Just the personnel on that team were great passers and really didn't care about scoring the ball. We cared about scoring the team basket. I think that it just made the game more fun. I mean, I remember going to KC at one point in the season and saying, hey, can I, come out of the game first? And because sometimes it would be DJ or sometimes it would be me coming out of the game first. Seesting would come in, and we basically had a three-guard rotation. And we would just rotate around. But I wanted to come out of the game first because I wanted to play when Bill played. Because, Larry and Kevin were such dominant players. And they were so highly efficient that our offense was just get the ball to them. And, if a lot of games my guy doesn't leave me, so I don't ever get a shot. And so it was just fun to play with Bill because, like, Bill and Larry, because they were such great passers, but I wanted to sort of play with the second unit because Walton was always looking to pass. If you threw the ball in the post and you cut, you're getting the ball. Or you're just moving on the weak side, he's looking to pass. So I think Walton definitely, like I said, best passing center ever, enhanced that spirit of our team for sure and made us what I would call the greatest passing team ever. But it was really fun to play with Bill. His outlet passes, he didn't like to run very much. He one time yelled in practice as he's running down the court. He could barely move side to side anymore. So as he's running down the court, I think it was Jerry Seesting that got in his way. And he just ran over Seesting. And then he screamed and yelled, "The only thing I hate more than guards is backup guards." When you're winning, it sure helps team chemistry. And we had a lot of salty guys that if that team was not a winning team, it would not have been a happy locker room. But I really believe that everybody knew that we had something special. There was just something very special and unique about that team and that experience in that year and the fact that we were healthy. Walton played 80 games that year. And, that was a miracle. At age 33, for a guy that had been doing whatever in Mexico and going to school, supposedly, going to law school. I don't know what he'd been doing for years, but I think I had played more minutes of Walton, and I was in my fifth year, and he was in his 13th year. And we used to joke about stuff like that and tease each other. Nothing is sacred in a locker room. And it was a really loose, fun group of guys. And the personalities got along fine, and especially on the court. And whenever there was issues in practice or some sort of salty behavior after a tough loss, it was easily forgotten the next day, and we moved on.
Ainge talks about how the camaraderie on the team was such a huge strength, with Bill Walton a major reason for that group being so close.
Well, Bill was hilarious. The guy was, I remember we were working out before the season and playing basketball pickup games at Boston College to try to get going. And Bill has to go to North Dakota to sit in for an Indian reservation. He's going to go participate in a big sit-in. And I don't know what they were doing there, but smoking peace pipes, I'm sure, had something to do with it. But Bill, I remember one day showing up at Hellenic College in a locker, and we had Grateful Dead stickers plastered all over our lockers. And I went up to Bill, and I said, "Bill, you got to, help me with this Grateful Dead stuff. I'm not feeling it. Why don't you give me some music of theirs that you like?" And so he gave me, I don't even remember what it was, but some cassette or whatever on the Grateful Dead, and I went home and I actually listened to it that night and was listening to the music, and I came back the next day and I had the cassette in my hand, and I said, "Bill, I'm not feeling it. What is your very favorite song from the Grateful Dead?" And you know, because I really want to try to, you know, see what you're seeing. And he grabs that cassette out of my hands and he goes, when you're a Dead fan, it's all one song. But that was just Bill. I mean, he was hilarious. He just made me laugh every day. The guy was just such a crack up. But he was into his Grateful Dead and had his tie-dyed shirts and was passing those out, you know, in the locker rooms and stickers everywhere. And that was part of his family. And I still don't get the Grateful Dead, but he still loves it.
Another reason for the team being such a tight unit was their head coach.
That's what I would say about KC, he was a good leader. And our team was, that's what we needed. We needed someone that would lead us, someone that wouldn't get in the way. What I appreciated the most about KC Jones was his tough-mindedness and like when he saw something. I remember one time in particular, you know, DJ was not behaving like he would normally behave. And DJ was a great teammate and a lot of fun to play with, but he was not happy that Kevin didn't pass him the ball out of a double team. And so he sort of acted out on the court. And I remember KC was so mad that he actually challenged DJ to a fight in the locker room after the game. Like, you know, you're not gonna screw this team up. You know, and DJ was, you know, like apologizing and like, no, and DJ was great. But I mean, like KC was willing to just like do whatever it took. We're not gonna have any of that. And was a great leader for us. And, but we had been, all of us had been coached by Bill Fitch. And so Bill Fitch was a terrific X and O coach, had taught us a lot about the game. Most of us had come from very good college programs and great coaching. And, you know, we needed somebody that was going to let us play. And, you know, the other thing I loved about KC was he asked for our input. You know, I'm going to play Isaiah Thomas, and he would, like, how do you want to defend? How should we defend it when Lambeer sets the screen and when Mark Aguirre sets the screen? And, you know, he would get the input from the players on how we should do it. It wasn't a dictatorship. It was a partnership with the players, and I loved that about KC and appreciated that and thought that was very wise.
The Celtics advanced to the NBA Finals, but the team waiting for them wasn't who they thought it would be, thanks to a miraculous shot.
I still remember seeing that circa shot by Ralph Sampson, you know, that little fadeaway side turn shot that went in the basket. I was shocked. Even though the Rockets were a really good team, you know, I had so much respect for the Lakers and their team and their talent. You know, Byron and James and Kareem and Magic and, you know, right, and Michael Cooper. I mean, like, I had so much respect for those guys that I was really surprised. But the Rockets did get our attention, and you know, Keem and Ralph and the whole, you know, Rodney McRae, right on down, the Wiggins, the Robert Reed, those guys were really good. And they had great size. And so we had respect for them without question, but I was very, very surprised that the Lakers got beat. I remember feeling really confident that we were gonna beat them. You know, again, I think, it, you know, our only issue was, were we gonna be at our best? Like, I knew we would have been if we'd have played the Lakers. And that was a concern. But, I mean, the Rockets were a very good basketball team and very well coached, and we knew Coach Fitch, and we knew what a great coach he was. But we knew that they would give us a challenge.
The Celtics led the series 3-1 heading into Game 5. A bad loss in Houston once again gave the Seas extra motivation heading home.
Well, what I remember about that situation was I don't think anybody said a word in the locker room after the game. You know, sometimes when there was a loss, it was like, you know, someone would point out the things we got to do better, or, you know, we're not playing tough enough, or, you know, but there was nothing. There was no talk. It was like we could hear the Rockets fans celebrating and screaming, going crazy in Houston, and all the way getting on the bus and seeing the fans, you know, point Rockets number one out, you know, as we're walking to the bus and so forth. And there was a sting to that loss. And I mean, we just gave the game away. And we all knew it. And it was just, you know, we'd had that pattern throughout the year to sort of let up a little bit. And so we got to practice, or we flew the next day commercially. And we arrived in Boston for a practice. And there were still no conversations. The next morning, there's no conversations. There's no conversations going to practice. And we get in practice, and I remember our starters were just crushing the second unit. I mean, it was 10 minutes into practice. KC just called off practice, said, "We're ready. Go home, rest, see you tomorrow." And, you know, we were focused and ready. And we took care of business in game six.
In that Game 5 loss, there was a memorable confrontation between Ralph Sampson and Celtics reserve guard Jerry Seasting.
I thought it was a funny situation because, you know, usually that would have been me that would have got in the fight with the big guy. Matter of fact, I've been accused of being the guy that got in the fight with Sampson. But we used to run a play where Sampson would shoot the free throw, and because Parrish was such a great runner, and as he would shoot the free throw, Parrish would, you know, take off down the court, and the guard would stand right behind the free throw shooter and set a back screen on him. So, like, I could relate to what Jerry went through because, like, that really frustrated big guys. You know, they shoot a free throw and they're backing up and boom, you know, they're nailed by a guard and then Parrish flies down the court. And so, yes, Ralph did not like that. It wasn't the first time he'd been hit by a back screen, but, you know, but Jerry got him with the back screen and that just set Ralph off. And, you know, Jerry is like everybody on that team. Like, he's not backing down. I mean, Jerry's the littlest guy on the court, and he's going at Ralph Sampson, a 7'4 guy with a 7'6 wingspan. I mean, you know, that got Houston riled, and that got the crowd going there. And I think that it really got that team, you know, going and making shots and really pumped them up. And we let our guard down. But I was glad it was Jerry and not me, for once. I've even told Jerry since, you know, like, yeah, people still to this day, like, yeah, when you get in a fight with Sampson, I go, no, that was Seasting.
Boston, of course, won Game 6, and another banner was raised to the Garden rafters.
You know, I just remember winning the championship, and it was a great relief, and it was a great journey that year, and the confidence, I just remember, like, the times of that season being way more confident than in 84 and 85 and 87, because 87 we had injuries and it sort of changed our dynamic, but it was, it just felt we were invincible. Like, there's no way anybody's gonna stop us. And it was just a great feeling. But at that time, I don't think any of us really thought about best team of all time, best team in history. Like I said, we weren't chasing records. We weren't chasing history. There wasn't talk of historical, you know, were we better than the 65 Celtics team or anything like that. It was just about, you know, redemption from our 85 loss, which was very painful because we could have easily won 84, 85, and 86, and we let 85 get away. And I think that 86 was a great, great feeling and an incredible year. I think it would have been more special to beat the Lakers. I mean, like I said, from the opening day of training camp, you know, I don't care if anybody will admit this, but we were looking at the Lakers. I mean, we really believed the Lakers were the team that we were going to have to beat. So it was a disappointment. And like I said, we had the ultimate respect for the Lakers. And like Byron and James, you know, Byron Scott, James Worthy, are, in my opinion, are two of the most underrated players in NBA history. Those guys were very, very special players. Magic and Kareem obviously get a lot of the attention, and rightfully so. But, you know, when there's talk of the greatest teams of all time, I think that the 86 Celtics belong at the top. But if somebody were to say, you know, the 85 or 87 Lakers, I can, you know, live with that. That's how much respect I had for those teams as well. And that was an amazing rivalry.
As history would play out, the years following the 86 title were filled with injuries and tragedy.
Well, it was really hard. You know, I was with Len Bias at 11 to 12 o'clock at night. He had just signed a contract with Reebok, who I was with, and with his agent, Lee Fentress, in Boston. I woke up the next morning and was going to play golf and stopped to get gas. And the gas station attendant told me that Len Bias had died. And I said, like, no, he didn't. I was just with the guy like 8 hours ago. There's no way. And it was just like shocking. And I was just devastated. And then Reggie was a dear friend, and watched him grow as from his first year to his second year, and develop into an all-star player. Those were crushing blows, because at that same time, Kevin had the broken foot, and he was never the same player. He was still a good player, but he was never what he was in 1986, in 1985, in 1984. And Larry, had the double Achilles tendon surgeries and the back injury. And as great a player as Larry was, he was never the same after that, as he was in 84, 85, 86, and peaking in 86. And so the injuries to Kevin and the injuries to Larry and the death of Len Bias, and then ultimately the death of Reggie Lewis, who, might have been able to carry the torch. Bias and Lewis for sure together could have. It was a very dark period. And I was grateful at that time, quite honestly, to be playing in Portland in the NBA Finals and Western Conference Finals, and be playing in Phoenix in the Conference Finals and NBA Championship. And that was a great opportunity for me. And I had a blast, continuing to play at a very high level of competition, and play against the great Jordan teams and the great Magic teams, out west. And that was a great experience for me that I'm very grateful for.
Danny Ainge would personally help the franchise get back to its championship ways more than 20 years after his role in the 86 championship.
In 2007, summer of 2007, when we got KG and Ray, I felt something special that, that I hadn't seen in Boston for years and years. And, Paul was sort of our foundation, and a disappointing time for him and a very difficult challenge for him, not being part of much winning. They'd gone to the finals, or to the Eastern Conference Finals, 1 year, but the next year in the lottery. And I think that to see the Paul return spiritually as a player, like to find the child in him and the love and passion for the game, and with the arrival of Kevin Garnett and with the arrival of all three of those guys were coming off lottery teams, and when those three came together, it was something very special. Doc claims that there was this big unity that was built in Europe during training camp. And I felt it in July and August and September. And I think if we'd have held training camp out in Waltham's parking lot, we could have still won. There was just such a feeling. And, Doc being a great coach and having those three guys come together at the same age where winning was all that mattered, and having a really good cast of characters around them, that was equal of a highlight for me as 1986, because as a executive, seeing all the stories from Rondo to Kendrick Perkins to Leon Poe and Eddie House and James Posey, and the three stars and Doc Rivers, and to see the legacy of these great people, and to get that first championship for most all of them, was very, very special. The NBA in the 80s and 90s was spectacular. I think the NBA now is better. I think the talent is a little bit watered down, because I think there's only a certain amount of superstars born. And so with 30 teams, even though more people play basketball around the world, I still don't think there's enough superstars to fill up 30 franchises. And if you were to consolidate down to 23 like there was in 1986, can you imagine the talent level of those 23 teams in the NBA? You'd have 23 teams vying for NBA championships if you were to consolidate our league to 23 teams. But I like the game today. I love the game. I get a little frustrated when I hear people say, oh, you know, basketball's not the same as it was when you were playing. And maybe people think that's a compliment, but I love basketball. I love the NBA today. I think the game has evolved, the three-point line. I wasn't a huge fan of it. I never grew up playing with a three-point line. It took us, you know, 5-6 years into our careers before it even became a major factor in the game. Now it's obviously a huge factor. But watching the stars of today, they're every bit as good as the stars of our day. And I'm impressed every night I watch NBA basketball by our play. I love watching our Celtics teams, even though I don't really believe we're a title contender this year. We're building a championship and building toward a championship, but I love our passion. I love the energy. I love the talent. And the guys work harder than we worked. They put more time in the weight room, more time on their diets, more time, you know, taking care of their bodies. I think the talent and athleticism is every bit as good. I think the great players from every era can play, you know, could cross over from era to era. But I think the NBA is in great hands with the stars that are in our league today.
So where does Ainge rank his 86 Celtics team among the all-time teams in NBA history?
I don't pay much attention to that. You know, now maybe because there's talk about it because of, you have a team like the Warriors that are getting so much attention, and they deserve all the attention they're getting. But I don't really think about that. For me, it's more about, the experience will always be part of my memory. Always be fondness, but the relationships that you develop through those experiences. You know, every time I see Bill Walton and I'm out college scouting and he's doing a Pac-10 game and we have a big hug, and every time I just saw Kevin yesterday, he came and spent 4 hours watching NCAA basketball with me. Larry, we don't have DJ with us any longer, which was sad, but I mean, we had a special bond. And I just think that's where the greatness of our experience is, this bond that you build as players and people going through those experiences is way more meaningful than what the pundits have to say about who's better or who's not.
Thanks so much to Danny Ainge for sitting down with us to talk about the 86 Celtics, among other topics. Again, make sure to look for new episodes of the 86 Celtics interviews every Tuesday and Thursday on csnne.com. You can also subscribe to our iTunes feed or look for us on other podcasting apps. This is Abby Chin, and we'll see you on the next episode of the 86 Celtics interviews.